Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Near and far, and welcome. Oh, such a beautiful day. Reminds me of my childhood growing up in Calgary, where we would have these beautiful blue skies and, you know, crisp, cold autumns. And then go Halloweeny, trick-or-treating. I was never one to throw eggs, though. Although I did do some things with toilet paper, which probably annoyed people. I think, as most people here know, but perhaps not all, this practice period we're focusing on koans from this collection called the Book of Serenity. There's 100 of them in here. And they usually have a little introduction and then the actual case, as it's called, the koan itself, and then a commentary. And they're a little bit challenging to read unless you read a lot of them and then start digging to understand what they're getting at, because they were written, or mostly written, in the Tang Dynasty or the Song Dynasty, which means from about 700, actually early 600 or late 600s in China all the way up to about 900. So that's kind of where the collection comes from. You know, and as I was preparing this talk, I thought, you know, one of the great things about thumbing through a book with 100 stories, 100 koans, is that if you pay attention as you read, something jumps out at you. And before you know it, it's kind of nested somewhere in the synapses. So as I was looking through the book thinking, well, what am I going to talk about for today? This particular koan jumped out at me. And it's case 62. Actually, what's the title of it? It's called Mihu's, which is a name of a teacher. Mihu's Enlightenment or Not. Enlightenment or Not. So I'm going to read you it first, and it probably won't make too much sense. I'm going to read the introduction and the main case. The introduction begins, Bodhidharma's highest truth, Emperor Wu's confusion, Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality, Manjushri's verbal excess. Is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? And then the main case goes, Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yangshan replied, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, who deeply agreed with this. Well, I'll kind of hopefully say a few words about all of this, so maybe by the end it will make a little bit of sense, maybe not. But I think this, you know, really offers us a really intriguing question. Do people these days need enlightenment or not? But let's make it more personal. Do I need awakening or not? There are, you know, so many possibilities open to us. Countless ways we can spend our time in pursuit of happiness. Myriad ways we can distract ourselves from the confusion and pain of this life. Mihu, this teacher, brings up a decisive question that really we all need to answer as we follow this path of practice. I think for some of us, when we first take up practice, the urgency of our discontent The severity of our pain compels us to answer in a loud voice, yes, I need something. I need some relief. I need to awaken. I need something. And for other people, for other of us in this practice, as we engage, it builds over time. The value and truth of this practice becomes clear. And we also answer, yes, this path of awakening, very precious. Yet I think for everyone, at some point, doubt arises. Do I need this? Do I really need this? What is the purpose of following this path of meditation, zazen, retreats, chanting, community? What is the purpose of all this? What am I doing with this life? Is it worth all the effort and time that I put into this? I think especially as most of us, of course, are living a lay life. You know, we're not in a monastery somewhere doing this 24/7. We have a life. We have a life full of obligations. Obligations to work and family, to other social commitments that we have. So this is a question I think we must each ask and answer for ourselves. And this is not easy. It's not easy to truly ask and to truly answer, because we are essentially asking the fundamental question of our life. What is this life? What shall I do with this life? Throughout all of the Buddhist history, both in the Zen tradition and other traditions as well, we see the stories of our ancestors. We see in their stories a call to respond to their own impulse to awaken. Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher who first brought this form of practice from Japan to North America, Suzuki Roshi said this about the Buddhist understanding of wisdom. He said, "This wisdom is not intellectual or knowledge. This wisdom is our so-called innermost nature, which is always an incessant activity. Zazen practice is wisdom seeking wisdom. Wisdom seeking wisdom is our zazen practice, our meditation practice. Wisdom seeking wisdom is our innate impulse to awaken." I was thinking about this. We may say there are kind of two forces at work. One is the dissatisfaction, or to use the Sanskrit word, the dukkha, that arises in life over and over again, right? Dukkha is any kind of dissatisfaction, from something very minor to something very extreme. Right? We miss the bus, to profound grief. All of that arises in our life. How will we meet it? How will we deal with it? So this dukkha is stressed in some forms of Buddhism as the main motivation for practice, the primary cause to take up a spiritual practice. And then there's the other main force that Suzuki Roshi calls wisdom seeking wisdom, our innermost nature calling to be fully expressed. I think this is a lot of our dissatisfaction. We are not fully alive. We're not fully being ourselves. Wisdom seeking wisdom. How do we express our life fully? So these forces turn us towards searching. But we don't often look in the right places. Or maybe we have to look first in the wrong places before we can look in the right places. So seduced by the ubiquitous messages, you may think, for example, if I work hard, I'll succeed. And my success will be measured by wealth, security, power, recognition. And this in turn will bring me happiness, purpose, and peace. And if I'm not happy with my life, then it's because I don't have enough wealth or power or enough recognition, probably because A, I'm not good enough, or B, I did not work hard enough. I just need to try harder. I think many of us begin there. We look for some kind of outside cure for the dissatisfaction we feel inside, the hollowness we feel inside. The Buddha said there are two kinds of searching: ignoble searching and noble searching. Here's the quotes from the early texts, Buddha speaking. There are two searches, ignoble search and noble search. And what is ignoble search? There's the case where a person being subject themselves to birth seeks happiness in what is likewise subject to birth, being subject themselves to aging, illness, death, sorrow, defilement, seeks happiness and likewise what is subject to illness, death, sorrow, defilement. In other words, we're looking for some kind of happiness in things that are in constant motion and change and flowing, arising and disappearing. And then he says, there is the case where a person themselves being subject to birth seeing the drawbacks of birth, seeks the unborn, unbinding. Themselves being subject to aging, illness, death, sorrow, defilement, seeing the drawbacks of aging, illness, death, and sorrow, defilement, seeks the agelessness, illnessless, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, unbinding. We seek for something else. So I think what this is saying, that the Buddha is telling us that an ignoble search fails because we believe that satisfying our desires is truly satisfying. If I can just satisfy all my desires, I'll be satisfied. I mean, it kind of makes sense. But lasting and deep satisfaction remains elusive. You ever notice that? You're having a great time at that party, and then suddenly it's not quite as great. Maybe you've had one too many tokes, too many drinks. Something. The noble search, however, comes out of a personal understanding of what causes our suffering. We don't rely on our attachments, but search for something that is, as the Buddha said, agingless, illnessless, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, and unbinding. And even not knowing what all that may mean, we begin a noble search because we become aware of our suffering and the causes of our suffering. Ever noticed how long satisfaction lasts when you get, I don't know, a new iPhone, a new car, new washing machine, new dishwasher. It's like, oh, so happy. And then the week passes by, 2 weeks pass by, and it's no longer quite so happy with that thing anymore. I think it's good that we do not know what the path of Zen really entails. At the beginning, of course, of a beginning of a course like college, like Seth is right now, our university student receives a syllabus, a good outline of all the readings, the lecture topics, assignments, exams. So you kind of feel, oh, okay, I know what's coming down the stream. But in the Zen practice, we don't tell newcomers that Zen practice is profoundly unsettling. It's not just tinkering with our lives, like a weekend workshop of some kind. Our practice is deceptive at first. Here's how Suzuki Roshi describes it. When we sit, we do not do anything. We just sit. There's no activity of our mind. We just sit, and all we do is inhale and exhale. Sometimes you will hear some bird singing, but you are not actually hearing. Your ears will hear it. You are not really hearing it. Just sound comes, and you make some response to it. That's all. This kind of practice is called wisdom seeks for wisdom. In other words, we let go of all the commentary we're telling ourselves, this constant dialogue that's going on in our minds about what we're hearing, what we're doing, who we are. Yet this simple practice will encourage us to let go of what is most precious to us, our strong sense of me, of Michael. This practice will illuminate what is covered in darkness, our vast true nature. And this practice will encourage us to persevere when we want most to give up and binge watch Halloween flicks. Anyway, let's go back to the koan, to the introduction. The introduction, remember, went like this, at least the first line of it. Bodhidharma's highest truth, Emperor Wu's confusion, Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality, Manjushri's verbal excess. You may remember at the beginning of this practice period, Kate and I acted out the dialogue between Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu, right? Remember that? When Bodhidharma met Emperor Wu, Bodhidharma being the teacher bringing this practice from India to China way back, the emperor asked, "What is the highest holy principle?" And Bodhidharma answered, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy." And Emperor Wu persisted, "Well, then who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." And when he departed the national, when he departed, the assistant to the emperor came up and said, "Do you know who that was? Do you understand what he was saying?" The emperor confessed, "I don't know. Don't know who that was or what he was saying." Bodhidharma's, "I don't know." And Emperor's Wu, "I don't know." How interesting. One an expression of truth, the other an expression of confusion. Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality, Manjushri's verbal excess. Well, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is one of the great texts of our tradition, at the beginning, many bodhisattvas, these kind of beings with have practiced from a long, long time, give their answer to Vimalakirti's question. Vimalakirti was a layman who was greatly awakened. Vimalakirti's question was, what is the gate of non-duality? In other words, how do we awaken? How do we understand the oneness, the unity of all things? What is the gate of non-duality? What is the gate to the highest truth? And all the bodhisattvas had given their answers. And then Manjushri, who is the very embodiment of wisdom itself, then congratulated all their bodhisattvas on their fine explanations of how to enter the gate of oneness, but then said, all their statements are themselves dualistic. They didn't demonstrate what oneness was. Manjushri then asked Vimalakirti how Vimalakirti would respond, and Vimalakirti remained silent. It is said, or it was called, a thunderous silence, and demonstrating non-duality itself. And then the last sentence of that introduction goes, is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? This is a little bit confusing. But to enter in actively in the Buddhist tradition means to enter in something free of attachment and free of delusion, to respond to the needs of the world without our own hindrances getting in the way. So let's go back to the main case. Mihu had a monk asked Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Now, not much is known about who this person Mihu, other than he lived in the 9th century in the ancient capital of Chang'an, but he had two interesting nicknames. Mihu, the seventh son, because he was the seventh child in the family, and Mihu, the barbarian, because he had a luxuriant beard, which was associated with barbarians. So, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Kind of a strange question. I was thinking about this. Maybe the implication is that in older days, people did practice awakening or rely on awakening, but nowadays, everything is so corrupt that we don't have what those ancient people had. So do people these days really need to awaken? Can they awaken? Should they still make the effort to awaken? Maybe that's what this question is about. Dogen talks about this particular koan, this question, in an essay that he wrote called Great Enlightenment. The question translated in Dogen's writing is, do people nowadays depend on enlightenment? But Dogen makes a really important point that I would just want to bring up here. He writes, the nowadays spoken of here in the koan is just right now, the now of each of you. Even if you think of the past, present, and future a million times, all time is this very moment right now. Where you are is nothing but this very moment. I think this is something we often forget. We forget this truth, that we are beings of the present. not beings of the past or beings of the future. We are simply beings of the present. To really ask this question, do people these days need awakening? We must also ask what we mean by awakening. Or more to the point, from the Buddhist tradition, from the Zen tradition, we need to let go of what we imagine awakening to be. Legend has it that the Buddha, upon his own awakening, said, "All beings, the great earth, and all things have awakened to the way." He saw the innate, boundless, and intimate nature of all things, the interpenetrating quality of being that is always present, whether acknowledged or not. To ask if people these days need enlightenment or depend on enlightenment already kind of separates us from our true nature. Yangshang, this other great teacher, responds to the monk's inquiry. "It's not that there's no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary?" This is where we so easily stumble. Yangshang tells us, yes, there is awakening. Maybe you have an awakening experience. You touch a little bit the truth of your own true nature. But soon, also soon, we can make it into something. We make it into something. It becomes a memory, an idea, a few words we repeat to ourselves and others. And whatever it was begins to fade. We may even stop seeking and stop being fully present in our life. Remember, Dogen wrote, "Where you are is nothing but this very moment." A memory of an experience is just a memory, helpful in a way, but if we cling to it, it becomes a hindrance. And this is true in all aspects of our life. If we hold on to our ideas, say, about our parents, our children, our friends, our lovers, our spouses, we fail to meet them as they are in this very moment. The expectation, the idea of who they are gets in the way. I've said this a number of times, but I'll say it again. If I think I know Kate, and I've lived with Kate for over 40 years. If I think, oh yeah, I know Kate. Mm-hmm. It's not long before I fall into trouble. To assume and to kind of hold that belief, to not always meet this moment of who is this person, is to die. This is one way that love fails to deepen and fails away, because we stop meeting this person. We live with them, we knock around. But who are they? And who are you at this moment? We fail to see the person before us, and they fail to see us. Confusion and hurt then arise. So somehow, we have to learn how to care for someone deeply, but not hold on, not turning them into our story about them, and not turning our story about ourselves into ourselves. Or our story of awakening, our awakening into a story of awakening. However light or deep our insight may have been. The practice is over and over again to let go, to live a life of searching, of asking, who is this before me now? What is this moment now? At this moment, you are in front of Yangshan. Speaking to Yangshan, you say, the world is a mess. My life is hectic. There's no time to go on session or retreat, let alone do a 90-day angle as required by all monastics. So I'm thinking I should just practice to relieve my stress, to lower my blood pressure, maybe stop being so angry all the time, and just forget about awakening. Do I really need awakening? Yangshan replies to you. It's not that there is no awakening, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? Yangshan is saying to you, it's not that you are not awakened right now. This is the boundless dimension of your life. It's just that you fall into the secondary. The secondary is kind of a code word for this relative world. The everyday world in which we love, we respond, we delight in, and the world that we suffer in. But the secondary is not second. There are not two separate stages. This world and the other world. This world of discomfort and the other world of paradise, bliss. No. This world and your true nature are mutually inclusive. The question Yangshan is asking, what will be done about falling into the secondary? He's implying now, how will you respond? How will you act right now in this world, this so-called world of relativity? There is awakening. There is your true nature. But how will you act now? With your stomach grumbling, hoping for lunch, and that this Dharma talk will finally come to an end. How will you give your life? So what is it? What is the awakening here and now in the midst of our daily life? From morning to night, we meet the joys and the sorrows of this life. We try to moderate our strong emotions. We try to be compassionate and loving. We try to do good in this world. And while doing all of this, we practice so as not to forget the mysterious boundlessness of this life. Over and over again, we practice to offer this life to the world as fully and completely as we can. Thank you.
Can you see your time clock?